Today, that's not a fall, this is a fall. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 9th of June 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, a story. In the great city of Gore, all the inhabitants were blind. A king and his entourage arrived nearby. He brought his army and camped in the desert, and he had a mighty elephant, which he used to increase the property's awe. The populace became anxious to see the elephant, and some cyclists from among the blind community ran like fools to find it. And as they did not even know the form or shape of the elephant, they grasped sightlessly, gathering information by touching some part of it. Each thought that he knew something, because he could feel a part. The man whose hand had reached for the ear of the elephant said, "It's a large, rough thing, wide and broad, like a rug." And the one who had felt the trunk said, "I have the real facts about it. It is like a straight and hollow pipe, awful and destructive." And the one who felt its feet and legs said, "It's mighty and firm, like a pillar." Each had felt one part of many. Each had perceived it wrongly. The parable of the three blind men and the elephant makes the point that depending on where you feel or look, you get a very different view of currently what's going on. And so too with the economy. For example, superficially, the latest GDP numbers released this week by the ABS were good news, showing a 1% growth in real GDP over the quarter and a 3.1% rise over the year. The Treasurer was effusive.
"In this year's budget, I said that everything that we endeavour to do depends on a strong economy. Today's national accounts show that the Turnbull government's plan for a stronger economy is working, and we need to stick to that plan. At the last election, we said that we would deliver jobs and growth. More than 1 million jobs have been created since we came to office in 2013, and since the last election, in last calendar year, we had the strongest jobs growth on record at more than 1,000 jobs created on average every day. Today's national accounts show that growth is also being delivered. The Australian economy grew by 1% in the March quarter and was up 3.1% through the year. That's up from the 2.4% growth that we saw in December. Now that, as you can see, is once again back up above the long run average again, and it validates the forecasts and the outlook that we set out in this year's budget and has been subsequently in recent times also endorsed by the Reserve Bank and the OECD, who have made very similar assessments about the outlook for the Australian economy. Australia has climbed back to the top of that leaderboard, which we've been seeking to do now for the past few years, and we are up again, leading the advanced economies of the world, bettering the average growth in the OECD, and of course all of the G7 nations once again.
But below the spin, things are not so clear-cut. In fact, net exports drove most of the growth because the terms of trade, which measures the prices received for Australia's exports relative to the prices paid for imports, rose by 3.3% over the quarter in seasonally adjusted terms and by 1.6% in trend terms. However, over the year, it fell by 2.6% seasonally adjusted and by 0.7% in trend terms. And these movements could be one-offs. We were fortunate. Quarterly final demand, which excludes export volumes, rose by 0.6% over the March quarter, driven largely by Victoria up 1.9% and New South Wales up 0.7%. But on a more relevant per capita basis, real GDP rose by just 0.7% over the quarter, and it was up by 1.5% over the year. And real national disposable income per capita also rose by 1.5% over the quarter and was up 0.9% over the year. And most importantly for Australian workers, average compensation per employee rose by just 1.6% in the year to March and remained negative by 0.3% after adjusting for inflation, which is 1.9%. It was 0.4% in the quarter. Plus, the household savings ratio continued to fall, down another 0.2% to 2.1%, the lowest reading in the post-GFC era. And what consumption there was went mainly to necessities like electricity and fuel. So my take is that while there is a glow of headline growth above 3%, in truth, it's mainly migration-led, plus a convenient shift in export prices and a rise in government investment. Private sector business investment is sluggish, and households continue to reel from low wage growth and rising costs, as signalled by falling savings and a rise in debt. Not such a good story then. And this is confirmed by the retail turnover figures. Also out this week, the ABS data rose 0.3% in April 2018, following a similar rise the previous month. Compared to April 2017, the trend estimate rose 2.6% above income growth. Across the categories, food retailing was up 0.4%, household goods up 4%, other retailing up 0.2%, cafes and takeaway foods 0.1%, department stores down 0.1%, clothes and footwear down 0.2%. And across the states, the trends were strongest in Northern Territories up 0.7%, the ACT was up 0.6%, New South Wales and Victoria were both up 0.4%, Tasmania was up 0.2%, Queensland was 0.1%, and South Australia fell 0.1%. Elsewhere on the elephant, we reported that mortgage stress notched up again in May 2018. You can watch our video, Mortgage Stress Updated, where we discuss the details and walk through the top 10 most stressed postcodes across the country. Across Australia, more than 966,000 households are estimated to be now in mortgage stress, compared with last month's 963,000. This equates to 30.2% of owner-occupied borrowing households. In addition, more than 22,600 of these are in severe stress, up 1,000 from last month. We estimate that more than 56,700 households risk 30-day default in the next 12 months, and we expect bank portfolio losses to be around 2.7 basis points, although losses in Western Australia are higher at 5 basis points. We continue to see the impact of flat wages, rising living costs, and higher real mortgage rates. The postcode with the highest count of stressed households was New South Wales postcode 2170, the area around Liverpool, Warwick Farm and Chipping Norton, which is around 27 kilometres west of Sydney. There are around 27,000 families in the area with an average age of 34 years. There are 6,974 households in mortgage stress here. The average home price is $805,000 compared with $385,000 in 2010. 64% of properties are standalone houses, while 22% are flats or apartments. The average income here is $5,950 a month, and 36% have a mortgage, which is above the New South Wales average of 32%, and the average repayment is about $2,000 each month. So the average proportion of income paid on the mortgage is more than 33%. The Reserve Bank left the cash rate on hold again this month. No surprise, of course, but the pressure on rates are on the rise due to the rising borrowing costs in the USA, as reflected in the bond markets and the local BBSW. Credit Suisse did a good job of dissecting the problem, and they estimate that banks have something like a 0.5% or 50 basis point gap in funding thanks to the change in rates. We discussed this in our video, so how much pressure on bank margins now? And there we look at the RBA's recent outing where they sought to explain away the pressure on rates. But Credit Suisse concludes the key issue is that the pipeline of out-of-cycle rate hikes is growing, with no end in sight, until the RBA resolves the pricing mystery in the interbank market. There is too much pipeline pressure for adjustments to be borne by just one lever of credit creation, because interbank spreads are so persistently and mysteriously wide. But recent commentary and the lack of responsiveness of interbank spreads to liquidity injections suggests to us that the bank is no closer to resolving the mystery than it was in April, when it first noted tightening. The sheer depth of the pipeline of out-of-cycle rate hikes due to elevated funding pressure is beyond what policymakers are currently envisaging. To be sure, banks do not have to hike rates out of cycle or limit pass-through of potential RBA rate cuts to end borrowers. They could cut deposit rates, or they could take a hit to profitability, effectively passing on the funding pressure to shareholders rather than borrowers. But interestingly, RBA work suggests that there are non-linearities in pass-through when cash rates fall, precisely because deposit rates are already so low. As the cash rate falls, the relative costs of low and no interest fixed deposits increases. Substitution out of higher yielding deposits into low, no interest fixed deposits offsets this increase in relative costs. But there is a limit to the offset once the cash rate falls too far. Second, if the margins take a hit, or are likely to take a hit, potentially banks could tighten lending standards even more aggressively than they currently are doing. Interestingly, interbank credit spreads currently point to a much sharper fall in loan approvals than our proprietary credit conditions index, based on publicly available data on bank lending standards. In other words, the growth shock from incremental credit tightening may be just as bad, if not worse, than out-of-cycle rate hikes or lack of pass-through. The issue is that corporate credit spreads are unusually low in comparison with interbank credit spreads. And UBS discussed whether banks are likely to be able to pull out from their current market price falls. Australian banks, they say, have now underperformed the Australian market on a rolling three-month timeframe, and the sector's PE discount to market X resources has widened to the most since 2008. They rightly argue that bank profitability and share market performance is all about credit growth. And indeed, the high growth in loans helped offset the fall in interest rates in the past couple of years. They conclude, UBS's work on the prospect of a tightening credit cycle suggests the ability to rebound from the current earnings lull will be very difficult, even if one subscribes to the soft landing scenario for house prices, credit growth and the economy. Credit growth should, at a minimum, grind lower over the coming years. Bank net interest margins are likely to be under at least moderate pressure given BBSW trends, while bad debts at absolute best will be a neutral influence. They say the muted earnings outlook suggests that one can subscribe to a soft landing for housing and the economy amid tighter credit, but still adhere to a strategic underweight in the sector. Of course, a sharper credit slowdown will compound the headwinds for the sector. And the fact is, so far, the RBA has never started a tightening cycle at a time when dwelling prices are declining, until now. So we hold to our view that mortgage rate pressure is on, and that will put more pressure on home prices, which continue to fall. The bellwether, of course, are auction clearance rates, which CoreLogic reported as now hitting a final weighted average last week of just 46.91%. The signs are clear as we head into winter that fewer properties are being sold, more are being passed in, and the number for sale is growing by the day. SQM Research said this week, we continue to see a shortage of properties available for sale in Hobart, but elsewhere the story is different, with greater supply now evident in most capitals compared to a year ago, leading to slow growth in property asking prices as supply increases. We're also seeing more property being listed in Melbourne compared to a year ago, which has taken pressure off asking prices for houses and units, which fell over the month. Even in Hobart, price growth has slowed despite the ongoing shortage of properties for sale there. CoreLogic's index shows that in Sydney, values fell by 0.11% last week, and the average values have fallen by 4.8% over the past 39 weeks. But this is an average, and some more expensive properties are down more than 15% now from their peaks. Auction clearances in Sydney's mortgage belt, which runs in a ring from the southern beaches around Canterbury, Bankstown, Parramatta, and the northwest, have collapsed deep into the mid-30s. Melbourne fell by another 0.07%, and dwelling values have now also declined by 1.7% over the past 27 weeks, but it is still positive by 1.9% over the past year. Two points to make here. First, again, the top of the market is moving sharply lower. And second, we think Melbourne is 6 to 9 months behind the Sydney trajectory, but is falling in the same direction. We are in correction territory now, and falls will accelerate. And frankly, as Sydney and Melbourne contain the bulk of the population and property, what happens in these two states will set the tone elsewhere. This week, we heard about criminal proceedings against CBA relating to the AUSTRAC saga, which, subject to court approval, will be settled at $700 million plus costs. A big number, perhaps, but much smaller than might have been the case, and hardly enough to be a real deterrent. We discuss this in our separate video and podcasts, what the CBA AUSTRAC settlement means. And the ACCC is going after ANZ, plus Deutsche Bank and Citigroup's investment banking arms, alleging they engaged in cartel-like behaviour relating to a share placement in 2015. We discuss this in our post, Now Investment Banking is Under the Microscope, available on YouTube or via podcast. And talking of YouTube, we ran our first live streaming Q&A session last Tuesday with a couple of hundred people joining in. You can watch the Hour 20 program on replay on YouTube, including the live chat, or listen to the podcast version. Thanks to everyone who joined in, and for those who sent questions in advance. I have to admit, we did not cover them all, so I plan an extra offline session to answer some of the outstanding questions in the next few days. We plan another live Q&A session in a couple of months, so watch out for that too. Before we finish, a quick scan of the global financial markets, as I've received feedback that this part of the weekly reviews are well received. First then, US stock markets rose more than 1% this week, but gains were held back in the later part of the week, somewhat as focus shifted to escalating trade tensions between the US and its key allies as the G7 summit got underway. US President Trump refused to back down from his tough stance on tariffs, as he vowed to fight for the United States and criticised allies, accusing them of imposing massive tariffs and creating non-monetary barriers. Techs were also one of the stories of the week after coming under pressure on Thursday and Friday as Facebook and Apple fell. Apple fell nearly 1% on Friday on reports that the iPhone maker warned its supply chain to make fewer parts for iPhones in the second half of 2018, amid expectations for lower sales. Shares in Tesla rallied sharply this week after CEO Elon Musk said that it was quite likely Tesla will hit a weekly Model 3 production rate of 5,000 cars by the end of June. The S&P 500 closed more than 1% higher for the week at 2,779. Crude oil prices posted a third straight weekly loss after setting lower on Friday on concerns about ongoing US output after data showed that the number of US oil rigs continued to climb. Oil price action was choppy for most of the week as OPEC members attempted to allay fears the oil cartel would lift limits on production curves at its June 22nd meeting. US oil output, meanwhile, continue to rise, as the Energy Information Administration said on Wednesday that US oil output rose to a record 10.8 million barrels per day. Oil prices were also limited by a weekly Energy Information Administration report showing US crude supplies unexpectedly rose by 2.072 million barrels in the week ended June 1. Crude futures settled 22 cents lower on Friday as data showed US oil rigs continued to climb, pointing to a sign of growing domestic output. The US dollar posted its first weekly loss in 4 weeks, despite expectations that the Fed will hike rates next week for the second time this year. 33.8% of traders expect the Fed to hike rates for a fourth time at its December meeting, up from around 30% last week. The Federal Reserve will also release its summary of economic projections outlining expectations for key measures of the US economy, including inflation, interest rates, unemployment, and GDP. The dollar was held back by a resurgent euro as the European Central Bank policymakers stoked expectations that the ECB would tighten monetary policy sooner rather than later. The dollar rose 0.12% to 93.54 against a basket of major currencies on Friday, and locally, the Aussie dollar held at 76 cents to the US dollar. Gold prices bounced back from a weekly slump as dollar weakness encouraged buying, which was tentative, however, with a widely expected Fed rate rise on the horizon. Gold prices were unable to capitalize on rising geopolitical tensions, as US President Donald Trump went to the G7 meeting, expecting a frosty reception after lashing out at Canada and the European Union. Gold appeared to be in wait-and-see mode through the week as trading was restricted to a narrow range ahead of the Fed rate decision and the release of the central bank's economic estimates. Bitcoin seesawed its way to end the week roughly unchanged as regulatory uncertainty continued to weigh on sentiment despite signs of increasing institutional demands for the popular cryptocurrency. A report this week that Wall Street giant Fidelity was eyeing a move into the crypto space, planning to create products that would push the market for Bitcoin to the next level, attracted a muted reaction. Bitcoin rose to a high of $7,777, testing a price level which some have identified as resistance, price levels that trigger selling, before pairing gains. On the regulatory front, SEC Chief Jay Clayton said this week that Bitcoin was not a security and further clarified the US financial watchdog's position on initial coin offerings, or ICOs. And so back now to the elephant analogy. There are a number of lumps and bumps across the US economy which suggest that pressure is building. For example, the flatter US yield curve underscores the lift in short-term rates, and there is more to come. Higher rates mean that individuals and corporations will have to pay more. This chart shows the growth in US personal debt and the fall in savings, a trend which has grown in the past decades. Debt has never been higher, and savings is through the floor. And remember that the US government will have to pay more for its debt. This is important because the US government is financing almost 25% of US GDP, and you have to ask whether this is sustainable. But we still expect US rates to move higher, putting more pressure on local rates here. And there are simply no signs yet of any improvement in wages here as costs go on rising. Meantime, the tighter lending controls and lack of sales momentum will see prices fall further. And by the way, ANZ was the latest to forecast bigger falls, so more are joining the chorus. But the question is still the extent and timing of these falls. Our modelling suggests that we will see more severe falls, and we will be discussing this in an upcoming post. But the bottom line is that compared with what we have seen so far, more falls must be expected, with all the downstream consequences which follow. If you like what you've heard here today, please like the post and add a comment or a question. If you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.